On the Record on News Talk,
brought to you by PwC, a community of solvers coming together in unexpected ways. It all adds up to the new equation.
Lots to come up, so I'll just have a quick browse through the front pages of this morning's newspapers. We'll start with the Sunday Times, which has a fairly stark and sobering headline. Ireland's COVID rate is now the 12th worst in the world. Ireland has the highest incidence of COVID-19 infection in Western Europe and the 12th highest in the world, despite having one of the most vaccinated populations, according to new statistics from the World Health Organization. Rising numbers of cases have pushed the 14-day incidence of the disease up to 959 per 100,000 people. That's a rise of 63% in a fortnight, and it follows one of the longest lockdowns on the planet. And I think, in fact, those figures were compiled by the WHO. They're done on a weekly basis, so they're not always the most up-to-date figures. I think the 14-day incidence rate in the Republic now is 1,035 per 100,000, which basically means that about one in every 98 people in the Republic has tested positive for COVID inside the last 2 weeks, which is really quite striking. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times this morning, a little bit of what you heard in the news bulletin from just a minute ago from Tom. COP26 pact agreed, but Eamon Ryan says that the terms around coal disappoint. A global agreement aimed at accelerating countries' efforts to keep the temperature rise below 1.5 degrees was agreed in Glasgow last night after bitter wrangling between emerging economies, the EU, America and the poorest nations over how the world should respond to climate change. In a late intervention, China and India insisted on watering down a commitment to phase out coal power to a promise of phasing down the use of that fuel. Talking a little bit more about that with John Gibbons a little bit later in the programme. And also on the front page, that opinion poll showing Sinn Féin now 16 points clear of its nearest challengers, Fine Gael, which we'll talk about in just a couple of minutes' time. The front page of the Sunday Independent is a preview of a fairly extensive interview done inside the paper with the former billionaire Sean Quinn, who has said that he will do all in his power to remove his former management team from the company he has founded. In an interview with today's Sunday Independent, which reveals the depths of his bitterness, Mr. Quinn said, "I will do all I can in my power to get those boys out." Referring to himself in the third person, Quinn said, "He is not what people think. He has not been responsible for all that is going on." And asked if he sees himself as the victim of the long-running saga, he says, "I think so. I believe so." He also claims that a local group of his supporters, the Cavan Fermanagh Leitrim Group, plan on suing for an equity stake in his former businesses in the north. He says that the community group now owns the businesses that he lost to the banks in 2011 and which were later acquired by a US-backed consortium for the Quinn family and for the community because he no longer wants the businesses. That's the front page of the Sunday Independent. The Business Post leads with the latest incredible turn in a fairly long-running story, it has to be said. Peter O'Dwyer did an awful lot of running about the National Broadband Plan when he was previously writing for the Ireland edition of The Times. He has brought it to the Business Post, and he tells us this morning that taxpayers are subsidising the rollout of high-speed broadband to tens of thousands of homes and businesses that already have access to high-speed internet through AIR's network. Data obtained by that newspaper shows that AIR has already passed more than 45,000 premises, which are included in the government's €5.7 billion national broadband plan, which aims to deliver fast, reliable broadband to more than 550,000 premises that are currently without it. The rollout of the plan by National Broadband Ireland to those same premises already now served by AIR would cost the taxpayer more than €245 million in costs to effectively duplicate the existing services. Alternatively, the company and the Department of Communications could choose to strip the premises from the broadband plan, thereby allowing NBI to claim up to €100 million in compensation for encroachment by private operators in the areas earmarked by the plan. Front page of the Business Post also tells us that multinational tech companies sought and were granted confidentiality before meeting a government minister to discuss Ireland's position on landmark new EU legislation that aims to rein in digital companies. Some of the companies asked through the IDA that no detailed notes be taken of their meeting, expressing concern that any records of what was discussed will be subject to freedom of information. This was before an online roundtable meeting between Robert Troy, the minister responsible for digital and company regulation, who met Apple, Google, Amazon, Facebook, LinkedIn, Airbnb and Vodafone, among others, in an online meeting on September the 21st. Also very briefly, motorists and cities are facing the prospect of new tolls, reduced speed limits, electric car only zones, parking fee increases and reduced road space as part of the government's plan to cut car emissions. More about that, I'm sure, possibly sometime in the next hour. And also for now, finally, the Irish Mail on Sunday. Give us vaccine boosters, not more lockdown. 8 in 10 people want the government to roll out a widespread booster vaccine programme for all adults, a new Ireland Thinks Ireland Mail on Sunday poll reveals. The survey also reveals that any return to lockdown would be hugely unpopular, with the vast majority opposed to renewed travel and social restrictions. And it's quite striking that so many people are in favour of receiving a vaccine booster when you consider that NPHET has been somewhat on the fence around the idea of what they see as medicating the public rather than having any other kind of restrictions on how people might go about their lives or other precautions to try and stop the spread of COVID-19. That is your quick tour of what's on the front pages of this morning's newspapers. I am joined in studio to talk about what is in today's papers by Gary Murphy, who's Professor of Politics at Dublin City University, and Gronin the AO reporter with thejournal.ie. Good morning to you both. Gary, I'll start with yourself because I mentioned the Sunday Times opinion poll. It's on the front page of the paper this morning. Sinn Féin up 6 points in the space of only about 4 or 5 weeks, and now almost as popular as Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil combined.
Yeah, 37%, Gavin, plus six. Fine Gael at 21 are no change in this in the Sunday Times BAI poll. And Fianna Fáil are 20 down two. And everybody else then is kind of in the 5-1 bracket, including Labour, who are at 3-2, which just goes to show the Evanna Batrick Dublin Bay South by-election triumph in June hasn't really helped or hasn't given them any great boost.
All politics being local, of course.
Well, quite indeed. As Jim O'Callaghan, I was at the game yesterday and I saw this big huge poster for Jim on the bus stop, talk to Jim, with a tiny little Fianna Fáil logo up in the corner. It was reminiscent of 2011. And if you go back to 2011, 10 years ago, Labour were at 19%. So, you know, they say a week is a long time. A decade is clearly a long time. Labour now, you know, basically in the cellar.
But 37% for Sinn Féin.
It's a huge number.
It's enormous. It's by some distance the most support that Sinn Féin has ever had in any recognised poll.
It's like 14% more than they got in the general election, where Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are stagnant from the general election, give or take a percentage or two. Sinn Féin have had this huge rise. Jody Corkin, in a very good piece in the Sunday Independent, titled Sinn Féin Poised for Decadent Power as Young Renters Buy Into Mantra, I think put his finger on it. There is a disillusionment, particularly amongst the young, in relation to health and housing in particular, where we see the colossal rise in rents and then the lack of rental facilities. Sinn Féin are coming with solutions. Now, the argument from their opponents is that all this is tremendously populist.
I think it's popular, which I think is the point.
The problem remains, of course, for Sinn Féin will be, you know, who do they coalesce with? And Alan Kelly, we know yesterday, he didn't rule it out, but he wasn't exactly very, he wasn't showing the love, let's put it like that. And then you look at the Social Democrats, the Greens, you know, the far left, will they ever go into government? I have my grave doubts. And cobbling 37% could get you, you know, on a very good day, even over 60 seats. You know, didn't Fine Gael get 37%, got 76 seats. Now the seat numbers were a bit higher in 2011. But I mean, this would be an extraordinary result if Sinn Féin would get this and seats. But I think the problem remains, who are they going to govern with?
If the margin were to be that high, because it's not only about the percentage that you get, but it's also about the strength of your opponents as well. But if they were to remain at the current levels where you have 37 plays 21 and 20, then that would be a really very close thing to an overall majority within striking distance. And then it's a case of, can you find the partners to fall over the line? I should say, by the way, there is another opinion poll today as well in the Irish Mail on Sunday, conducted by Ireland Thinks. This one taken yesterday. Sinn Féin on 32% in that one. That is up 1 point in the previous 4 weeks. Fine Gael 24, which is down two. Fianna Fáil 17, which is plus one. So again, Sinn Féin comfortably in the lead in that one as well, which I think I saw one deputy remark yesterday that it's now 11 opinion polls in the Republic in a row.
I think that's the key point. There is a tremendous consistency over 30% for Sinn Féin. And, you know, when you get consistency in the polls, they don't tend to go away. I mean, they tended to stay. Now, Sinn Féin will know that things can change. After all, Mary Lou MacDonald's leadership, there were mutterings within Sinn Féin itself after the catastrophic results the party had in Europe and the local elections in the summer of 2019. Yeah. And yet, 8 months later, they were getting the most votes in the general election. So, you know, they've got some very good strategists there who I think won't be getting carried away. I saw my local TD in Dublin West, Paul Donnelly, tweet that, you know, these were great numbers, but, you know, the work continued. And I think that would be the mantra for Sinn Féin.
Yeah, it was funny seeing so many different members of the parliamentary party tweet that line last night.
Exactly.
It's a useful reminder, though, that the Sinn Féin's fortunes have oscillated a bit wildly over time, that they did have a very disappointing local and European elections in mid-2019, and it was only 8 or 9 months later that they were regretting not having won more candidates. So it's a reminder that the public can be fickle sometimes. Do you think that Sinn Féin might be best advised to just make sure they don't take their eyes off the prize here?
Fickle, yeah, it might be a tricky word to use, because when if you look at all elections, all elections and governments, there's a lurching to one party, and then when they fail or when they're in government long enough, it lurches the other way. And look at the Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil governments, and this is kind of acknowledging that after lurching back and forward between the two, that's not really working in modern times anyway. And that's why there is a lurch to Sinn Féin. So it's not so much fickle as, like, you know, the way you might go to different providers to see what kind of best deal you can get for your car insurance.
Okay. And eventually your contract runs up and then you go to someone else.
Exactly. So
the cooling off period has maybe expired. What do you put the strength down to? Do you share Jodie Corcoran's analysis that it's a lot to do with the promises on housing, and whether they're deliverable or not is one thing, but at least the ambition is something that they don't see as being matched elsewhere?
I think I think from what I've heard of, you know, people my own age and just general talk on Sinn Féin, it's that they are creative and ambitious about what Ireland can do. And, you know, for example, the rent freeze, you know, there's a talk about freezing rents to kind of keep price, acknowledging that the prices are very high at the moment and that something needs to be done to the market to make it a bit more sustainable. And before the general election, Fianna Fáil said that that was impossible, unconstitutional, and Sinn Féin said they do it. And, you know, Alan Kelly said at the weekend that he did it as housing minister. So there's no constitutionality issue there, you know. So that is just one example of where they are probing. It's easy to do it when you're in opposition. There's always that factor there, but those kind of ideas appeal to people. And I think, you know, when you look at that Sunday Times poll, 44% satisfaction rating with Mary Lou McDonald, with those that said they'd vote for Fianna Fáil. Like, that's a very striking kind of acknowledgement that even though people are voting for Fianna Fáil, they like what Mary Lou was doing. They're also a really well-oiled political machine. You know, one of the things that is said about Sinn Féin a lot, but what day of the week is their parliamentary party on? I honestly great couldn't question, tell you, you know, because they are such a well-oiled machine. That is what happened after the local elections. Political organisations can have a bad election, but that the fact is they regrouped and they tweaked things and they did really well. And obviously they were riding on a wave as well.
The sports principle, win or learn, and that Sinn Féin really seemed to do that very well, that sometimes they even learn from their victories as well. Speaking of learning, because Gary, I know that you are also the author of Once Upon a Time, aside from a forthcoming book about Charlie Haughey Moore, which we'll be seeing about in future weeks, but you're also the author of a book called Electoral Competition in Ireland, which then means that you would be very well placed to see if there is any chart back to the previous strength for the Labour Party, which has had its conference this weekend and seems to be really scraping along the bottom again. That 4% in the Mail on Sunday poll, 3% in the Sunday Times poll, which I think is possibly its lowest ever score, which is not really what you want on the back of conference season.
No, certainly not. I thought Grainne made a very good point there, which was, you know, loyalty in Irish politics is gone. You know, the glory days of, you know, when I talk about Charles Haughey in my new book, you know, of getting 45% consistently, you know, obviously we're long removed from that, although Bertie Ahern, you know, again, got between 39 and 42. But there's no loyalty in Irish politics now beyond the real hardcore. I gave a talk to a Fianna Fáil group a couple of weeks back in DCU, and one of the students told me that he had been enrolled in the party on the day of his birth. And now, you know, those days are long gone for most people. Labour is tricky because the public hasn't forgiven it for the decision it took in 2011, the public writ large. And that was to go into government and to try and, you know, get rid of the Troika. That happened, of course. But, you know, the attacks from the hard left, People Before Profit, the Socialist Party and whatever other names they call themselves in the intervening years, really stuck, you know, that Labour had sold itself out. I mean, if it had stayed in opposition, you know, there was a growth trajectory there. People I talked to in the Labour Party said, you know, we had to put the country first, and we're glad we did it. But, you know, success, they didn't follow electorally. They were wiped out in 2016. Went for Brendan Holan, a safe, one might say, conservative choice. And Alan Kelly, the more, who was a candidate, of course, the first time. Now he has it, but, you know, that attraction isn't there because people are saying, well, you had your chance in 2011. You didn't succeed in terms of what success means. And we're looking at mostly Sinn Féin instead.
I need to get to a break before I do. Grainne, your thoughts on that?
It's funny because the Labour Party is kind of primed well as a post-pandemic party to do well, because there's been a lot of issues about workers' rights, workers' access to kind of proper, safe working environments, being able to get the vaccine during work hours, all these things.
And also like the whole idea and ethos of big state and big services and the state moving heaven and earth to try and make people's lives that bit easier, which has always been part of the philosophy.
And, you know, the things that was mentioned, that Alan Kelly mentioned at the party conference, you know, public childcare scheme, single-tier health system, retrofitting homes and cutting costs to acknowledge kind of fuel, or the living wage issue as well. They're all very much pandemic issues, you know. So it's interesting that maybe because he is a former minister that was in government, he is slightly tainted as leader, although I do think he is actually doing a good job. But they are a good party post-pandemic to kind of capitalize on the kind of issues that...
But the public don't seem to... Or it's not resonating. Mm. And you know, I was interested where Alan Kelly described himself as first and foremost a social democrat, which he clearly is. Yeah. But that space doesn't seem to be... Or it's contracted.
Now, if you pick up page 2 of the Sunday Independent this morning, you'll see an article saying that people going to conferences should take antigen tests. And read a little bit further on, you'll see that people going to indoor classical music concerts, business conferences or trade fairs should take an antigen test in advance, an expert group on rapid testing has recommended. The expert advisory group on rapid testing, which was set up by the government earlier this year, has developed a new risk assessment tool designed to produce a single minimum testing recommendation for a specific event or activity. Details of the tool are outlined in a letter to the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, who is anxious to see it used as the basis for more widespread use of rapid antigen testing across society. Well, one member of that expert group is Dr. Paddy Mallon, who's an infectious disease physician at St. Vincent's Hospital and a professor of microbial diseases at the UCD School of Medicine. Paddy, you're a member of this group. Thanks for coming on to talk to us this morning. Can you outline some of the group's thinking and the idea that you might have specific tests for specific activities?
Yes, so good morning, Gavin. So, as you said, the group was put together at the request of Minister Donnelly some months ago to have a look into this whole area. And as some of your listeners will probably know, across the world, there's a lot of different approaches to how antigen tests can be used as an additional public health measure. What we've done is we've taken an approach where we've tried to ensure that we have an evidence-based approach that we can update regularly, mainly because, as everybody knows, the situation around COVID changes almost on a daily, day-to-day basis. The tool that we put together has 4 main steps, and it looks at different activities that we would all may or may not be involved in as we go about living our lives. So the first step is to figure out the age profile of people that would be partaking in particular events. The next step is that we look within that age group at the background prevalence of COVID-19 on a given date or on a given week. And then based on that, we can look at the event itself and say, is this a higher risk or a lower risk event? Should someone with SARS-CoV-2 enter that event? So is it more likely to transmit within an event? And then finally, on the basis of that evidence, the fourth step is to apply an appropriate recommendation around testing. And it may be that no testing is recommended, or it may be that a certain level of either self-testing or supervised testing
okay.
is recommended.
I'm looking at the letter that was submitted to Stephen Donnelly. I don't know when it was published on the government's website, but I'm looking at it right now. One of the things that your group has listed as being high risk is the idea of eating indoors at a restaurant, going to a pub, going to a nightclub, or an indoor multi-household home visit. It all sounds like the sort of stuff that people would generally do coming up to a Christmas season where they're maybe socialising with people they haven't seen in a while. Is it your group's recommendation then that they would have an antigen test, but it would actually be one professionally administered?
No, so I think from a logistic perspective, when you look at antigen testing, and the group spent a lot of time looking into this, for community-based activities to try and reduce, the best approach is to have testing that's what we call self-sampling. So this is where people do their own tests at home. Mm. And there are a number of tests that have been recommended for that specific use that are fairly widely available. And the government has published details of those tests on the HSE website also.
But then, so if you are intending to go indoors to a restaurant or go to a pub or go to a nightclub, what exactly then is your group's recommended course of action?
So what we're suggesting to people is everyone looks at their lifestyle and their activities. As you say, we're coming up to the Christmas season. There's usually a lot more socializing, multi-household activities coming into that sort of season. If you're involved in that, we all want to ensure that we're actually partaking in these activities in a safe environment. And if you're taking part in these activities in a safe environment, our recommendation is that you should be testing at least twice a week if you're doing these activities regularly. The test should be 3 days apart. And the more people that do that, the greater impact that the testing will have on reducing risk of SARS-CoV-2 associated with all of these activities, and the safer these activities become for everyone. So this is less about an individual risk reduction. It's more about creating safer environments for us to be able to live our lives.
Does your group have any recommendation about how widely available antigen tests should be then? Because if you go to Britain, for example, I mean, I know all delegates at COP26 were handed out free antigen tests. They're available for free in the NHS. You take them and you had to take one every morning before you went in to try and make the event as little a risk as possible. Should Ireland be following suit? Should they be made freely available in pharmacies or at least subsidised below the current cost that they are?
I think there's a general consensus within the group that a level of subsidy is indeed needed. So if what you don't want is to recommend a public health intervention and then cost to be one of the big inhibitors of people actually taking part in a public health intervention, especially if we're asking society as a whole to increase testing, to reduce transmission and to make activity safer. You've got to make sure that, number one, that there's good access to tests, and number two, that the public trusts the tests that they're getting. And then the third thing is that they need to be affordable. Those recommendations and those thoughts have been passed on to government, and I'm sure they'll act on them in the coming weeks.
One thing you just mentioned there before I let you go, Paddy, you mentioned that people need to have trust in that system. It might be difficult for a lot of people in Ireland to have faith in antigen testing because of the commentary of some members of NPHET over several months. People will remember Philip Nolan once upon a time describing it as something akin to snake oil, and people hearing that maybe they miss as many positive cases as they might actually catch. And people will wonder whether in fact this is a robust technology at all. Did you have much of a difficulty getting NPHET over the line? Because I know NPHET have now adopted these findings, but this is something that they were quite opposed to for quite a long time.
So there's no such thing as a perfect test. And I guess the thing about antigen tests is we are aware of the limitations of the test, and we've factored all of the limitations of the tests into the evidence-based approach that the group has put together into that risk assessment tool. So all of that's been factored in as far as I'm concerned, and I think as far as most people in the field are concerned, that conversation has been had, and we need to move on in the knowledge that the tests have positive as well as negative features. You factor those in and you find out how best to use the test to reduce risk, and that's the approach that we're taking at the moment.
Paddy Mallon, infectious disease physician at St Vincent's Hospital and professor of microbial diseases at UCD. Thank you very much for joining us this morning on The Record. Fascinating recommendations. We'll see what the government makes of them this coming Tuesday. Grainne, I think you had your hand up immediately that something there was raising. I don't know whether a red flag or something that you thought was worthy of discussion there.
Oh, there was a good bit, actually. One of the things I thought was, you know, about the antigen testing catching as many cases as it misses, or missing as many cases as it catches, but it's still catching half. Well, you assume everybody's asymptomatic when they do them, half of cases that wouldn't earlier than they would be otherwise. And yeah, that does make a difference. You know, the other thing about the kind of types of activities, I was glad to hear conferences in that, because it's not just recreational social activities we should be looking at. And I think that's what a lot of the talk is around restrictions. It's like not meeting households, not going to pubs and restaurants. But you need those activities in society as much as you do kind of the stuff that earns you money and the stuff that keeps the economy going. And it is increasingly frustrating for individuals to be told that they can't go out and have and enjoy themselves, but they have to keep working at the rate they did before the pandemic started.
Yeah.
That is kind of going to be difficult for the government to keep asking people to do as time goes on.
Gary?
Yeah, well, I was interested to hear Professor Mallon's point about cost. I'm not sure how much an antigen test costs, but in a case,
the exact same ones that were handed out for free for all delegates at COP, which I think are the standard ones that the NHS is administering. I saw one in the chemist close to my house for €6 individually the other day. I saw that someone else was tweeting this morning to say they were going to meet a friend yesterday evening. Neither has symptoms, but they just wanted to make sure they didn't infect the other or pass it onwards. They both wanted to take antigen tests before they actually met up. They found it very difficult to get hold of any at all because a lot of chemists are sold out. And then eventually it was £8 a pop for each of them to take a rapid test to make sure it was safe for them to meet up.
And so for twice a week, I mean, you're talking, if you're going out to a concert or you're going to a nightclub or you're just going to the pub to meet your friends. And, you know, I teach in the university. We have large classes in back, which is good. I mean, teaching on Zoom, I think I told you before, is a terrible course for both lecturers and students. Would they be required to take an antigen test? Because they're all mixing very closely with each other. They're wearing masks in the classroom, and then they go to the canteen and they take them off. Everything is open again, which is good. So I think it's slightly more complex. But, you know, £12 a week, €12 a week is not insignificant for all, you know, for a variety of classes, age groups, students, you know, and people who are struggling to pay bills, pay rent. We see people paying 3/4 of their income on rent. So, you know, I think if the government doesn't get the cost base right, you know, I see this going nowhere. But I was struck in the week that Austin Curry died, you know, and Seamus Mellon's famous quote of "Sunning day for slow learners." One could say antigen for slow learners, yeah. In relation to the change, yeah, we have now from the public health advice.
Certainly, cost is going to be a big issue, Grainne, when you look at page 7 of the Sunday Times and Stephen O'Brien telling us under the nicely provocative headline, "Young people set to party like it's 2019 this Christmas." And if people really want to go back to having a Christmas of the pre-meaningful stakes, and if they're going to be living as if the virus wasn't around, if they are being asked to try and do sensible things, the state kind of has to come on board and at least make it more cost effective for them.
This is it. And, you know, part of the problem, I would say, is that they weren't expecting to have to recommend antigen tests for people at this stage. You know, part of the reason I think there was hesitancy, to put it mildly, from NEFA about antigen tests is obviously they said we have PCR, we don't need them, but they had trust in the vaccine. The government's and NEFA's strategy has been vaccinate the population. We're now experiencing a surge that proves that that isn't enough. And if we had... No, obviously we didn't know that back then. We're in a very fluid situation. But, you know, if we look at the government's response about heavily relying on the vaccine, that was the easier thing to do. And now we're kind of caught on the hop,
yeah,
that we don't know. We have to catch up on all the other measures we can do, you know.
Which is probably why Luke O'Neill is saying in his piece today in the Sunday Independent that the headline says that we simply have to use every trick in the book, that it has to be vaccines plus ventilation plus antigen plus a whole load of other things.
Absolutely.
To try and keep us safe.
Rachel Lavin's piece kind of goes into, you know, plan A has failed, what is plan B? And you're going, God, what else could we do? Like 90 plus of the population has a vaccine. But and when you look at the kind of incidence rates in Ireland, you know, Rachel Lavin mentions that in other countries that are doing worse than Ireland have very low rates of vaccination. So it's a couple of the things that she mentions that we could do, and that Ireland doesn't perform well as other European countries, is restrictions on social gatherings, such as nightclub venues and how they're managed and ventilated, the availability of testing, and also restrictions in schools. And obviously that last one is quite a sore point for people.
I'll come to that, because there's a very interesting letter, which we don't usually read on this programme, but a letter written to the editor of the Sunday Independent, which I'll come to in just a minute. But a couple of texts into 53106. Colm says, if antigen testing becomes mandatory, then they need to not only be subsidised, but there has to be price regulation. We don't want a situation like we saw at the start of the pandemic, where disposable masks that were being sold by some pharmacies in a box of 40 for €10 were then being sold for €5 each after the pandemic by the same pharmacies. And Paul says, Gavin, we are paying for tests that in the UK they literally give away for free. I'm not suggesting we should always follow their lead. Thank God we didn't with COVID. But please, would someone just make it free? Which, of course, reminds me that, in fact, there are probably some chemists, not to pick on Dundalk, for example, but there's some chemists in Dundalk where you can probably walk in and pay €7 or €8 for an antigen test, which if you went across the border to Newry, you could get a box of 7 for nothing. Which would really makes you wonder exactly what way we're going to go about it. That letter to the editor that I mentioned in the Sunday Independent. Firstly, it's very striking because usually the letters that are printed by the Sunday Independent are not quite as long or as comprehensive as this. And I'm not going to read out the whole letter, but it's very telling about some of the issues that school principals are facing right now. This is written by a primary school principal just talking about their experience of COVID in their setting and some of the difficulties they're running up into. And this is just some extracts from it. As of 3 p.m. Friday, I've had a 14.7% positivity rate for COVID-19 in school over the last 2 weeks. As of 3 p.m. on Friday, I had 48.3% of children absent. As of 3 p.m. on Friday, I had nobody from the HSE make contact with me. I finally managed to track down a HSE doctor on Saturday afternoon. I tracked him down, not the other way around. I was not looking for my school to be shut. I wasn't looking to send children home. I was not looking for the dreaded online learning to recommence. I was looking for support and advice because I'm answerable to a board of management, a school community and my staff. Everyone needs assurance that the right thing to do was to plough on through the situation. The doctor I spoke to was very affable and told me that my school had not reached a threshold of cases for action to be taken. Perfect. I now have a party line to give to the school community, but he didn't tell me what that threshold is. And in order to speak to him, I had first spoken to someone else who challenged me about my statistics. How did I know, for example, that I have a 14% positivity rate? Well, the parents of the children who tested positive rang me and told me. But of course, it could be higher because not all parents have contacted me and they're not obliged to do so. Could I prove that COVID was spreading in my classes? Of course not. And I didn't try to say that I could. But what I could say was that when one child in a pod tested positive within a few days, many more were also testing positive. And what about the huge rate of absenteeism? Well, they fall into three categories. One, the positive cases themselves. Two, the siblings of the positive cases. And three, everyone else who is in a panic and simply doesn't know what to do because there is no contact tracing in schools. Taking all these factors into account and with the backing of my board of management, I've taken the step to notify parents if there is a COVID case in the class. Just one text. I simply say, we have been notified of a case of COVID-19 in your child's class. Please be vigilant for symptoms in your child. Of course, I shouldn't be doing this. It's against department advice. But look, what's the worst that'll happen? They'll fire me. And Norma knows but doesn't want to admit a sub can't be got for love nor money. And as for a principal, but that's a whole other letter. The name and address of that principal is with the editor of the Sunday Independent. But Gary, it's very striking about the constant mantra that you hear about schools being safe. And then you see what happens when the contact tracing stops, that cases balloon like that. Nobody knows what to do. Everyone wants to be prudent, but everyone's singing off a different hymn sheet. And meanwhile, case numbers in primary age children are ballooning.
Yeah, the line that stood out for me was that when I was looking for advice and support, and then the letter goes on to say I basically got no support at all.
I had to get fired for doing what I'm doing. I had to
do the chasing. I spoke to an aggressive person who said, how did I know I had 14%, which is pretty obvious because the parents told him or her. It's quite extraordinary. The other thing that strikes me about parental responsibility in this matter is, you know, most people want to do the right thing, and so they will tell their principal that there is a case. Mm. And then I think principals do have a duty of care to other parents and students in the class. Mm. You know, we know the disease spreads in confined areas, indoors. I think this advice that you shouldn't be telling your parents or the parents of it is misguided.
Yeah, there's one other reason why they say they want to do that, and it's a point that I left out in the first reading, but I should include it now. The person references an article that Kira Kelly of this parish wrote in the Sunday Independent last weekend, that children exhibit mild symptoms by and large, and that flu would be more severe. And that's exactly the feedback that I'm getting from parents. But I'm also being told that many children live with grandparents who are vulnerable. Children have parents undergoing cancer treatments, and currently those people can't be made aware that's COVID in the school. If I could just say that's
exactly the point. You know, the virus spreads. So, you know, if you're living with elderly grandparents or parents who are, you know, immunocompromised, it could potentially spread with fatal consequences.
We are going back to a world where people are working in offices as well. So grandparents are doing a lot of the childcare they previously weren't.
But if you have someone vulnerable at home, this is again where antigen tests can come in handy, because that, you know, it's not just schools, although with no contact tracing in there and so much mixing among people who are not vaccinated, 5 to 12 year olds, there is a kind of an environment where the disease can spread. And before they thought that, you know, Philip Nolan said at NPHET that they thought that the virus spread among 5 to 12 year olds at the same rate it did among people who are adults who are fully vaccinated. Mm. So that was kind of fine. But the problem is the cases have ballooned in communities. And when that happens, the schools are not going to keep COVID at bay. And that is kind of why we are going to see a shift on the schools, because it was fine when they didn't think we were going to see a surge in COVID-19 cases, but that has not happened. And the decision by the government to get rid of contact tracing in September has dated really badly, again, because the vaccination strategy is not working as effectively as we thought.
And without being too critical, like, I mean, it's a tricky business, you know. You don't want to be causing panic and scare, you know. And, you know, anyone who reads Richard Chambers' recent book, you know, knows the work, I think, that NPHET have a colossal amount of work that was put in over the course of the pandemic, sometimes in the face of tremendous hostility from government and from the public. So, you know, I tend to think that most people are doing their best, including NPHET. And, you know, it's tricky, but, you know, we have a rise in case numbers. And I think parents, as the primary educator, probably need to know that there is a case in a class where their child is in.
One thing that does always strike me is that whenever you hear members of NPHET questioned about that, and they are fairly insistent that the data does not suggest that schools are a venue of transmission above and beyond anything else, but they consistently say that the research is that if schools have preventative measures and other mitigation factors, that they are perfectly safe. But I thought that one of those mitigation factors was the idea of pods, and the idea of pods kind of seems pretty pointless if there is no longer contact tracing, because what is the point of being ring fenced off with 5 other children if one child testing positive does not automatically trigger any interventions for the other 5?
I was looking at this issue on Friday, and I have a piece on the Journal today about contact tracing in school, about what is working, how it's working and how it isn't. And teachers just feel left in the dark, that they just don't know, you know, kids are out and they don't know, they might have a third of their class out at any one time. And part of the reason why they got rid of contact tracing in September is to so that kids weren't out with no symptoms and didn't develop COVID just because they were close contacts, when there was only a 5% positivity in schools versus a 25% positivity in a household setting among kids. But the problem is, again, because there are so many kids out now, it is affecting kids' education. So you need kind of some sort of measures there so that if there is a positive case, that doesn't spread as much as it can.
They've gone from one extreme to the other, and there has to be some Goldilocks spot in between.
This principal has basically half of his or her school out, as far as I can see. Yeah. Isn't that right?
48.3%.
Like, that's half the school. And Grainne's quite right, you know. Primary school is where a lot of the foundations are built, as we all know. And you know, the more time you spend out of school, on top of the lockdown schooling, which I think everyone knows isn't being ideal, notwithstanding the great efforts of teachers. Yeah, I mean, that's where the difficulty is.
Now, Gavin Riley's still with you, 11:46 on the record, with you till 1 o'clock. Still joined in studio by Gary Murphy and Groin in the A. A few people have been in touch on Twitter. Lynn says, I just spent €50 so I can test my primary age child twice a week until the end of term, because there's no meaningful mitigations in primary schools. Someone else says, surely there is an obvious link between Ireland's refusal to encourage antigen testing and their very high current rate, which might seem sensible on the face of it, but then you look at how Britain has embraced antigen testing for many months, and their cases up until pretty recently were running higher than ours. As I said, still joined by Gary Murphy and Groin in the A in studio. There is an awful lot written about a topic which is not necessarily all that sexy, so to speak, but there's a lot written in today's papers, as it happens, about planning issues, where Gerard Howden, for example, in the Sunday Times is writing about how Bord Pleanála issues just keep on building up. Stephen O'Brien in the Sunday Times is writing about how an eastern bypass ruining might free up land for 2,000 homes. Colin McCarthy is writing in the Sunday Independent about how it's not going to be only trains but rather bus routes which solve our transport dilemma, part of that being because the planning issues involved in getting a new rail line built would mean that it all becomes a little counterproductive. There's a lot written, Gronie. I don't know if anything jumps out for you, but it seems suddenly that there's a confluence of pieces about a topic which doesn't usually get very much coverage.
Yeah, and it's interesting, I suppose, off the back of the COP26 conference, because we need to build a certain amount of infrastructure for a kind of a new society, not to sound too naff by phrasing it that way. But, you know, Gerard Howden is quite strong on it, as he usually is about these issues. He calls, you know, the idea that the flat contradiction between people demanding large infrastructure projects and the burgeoning industry in crowdfunding judicial reviews against them, which kind of definitely represents a view out there that there is an effort to try and build Ireland and develop Ireland in a kind of a way to cater for the society we have at the moment, and it's not happening because of planning laws. And one of the things that was said to me by MEPs about kind of climate change projects that we need, for example, offshore wind energy supplies, is that we probably need to have a special planning route for those climate change projects, because we don't have the time to wait 2 or 3 years to fight stuff in the courts or fight applications and things like that.
Until somebody disputes whether it is actually a climate project or not, and they have to go to court to ascertain.
Listen, we can't, there's always going to be an issue with kind of planning projects, but it does, it's an important, I know you're saying, you're actually dead right that this isn't a topic that is discussed a lot, but it actually is so important, because we are not going to get the projects that we need to kind of cater for society. Housing is obviously a huge issue as well around planning, you know, NIMBYism and, you know, wanting the right kind of housing, but also it's urgent. Can we afford to kind of object to any type of housing at this stage?
Well, one thing, Gary, which struck me, which is how planning might relate to the likes of rail and the likes. I was talking to Barry Cowan on The Tonight Show on Virgin Media earlier this week, and I said, you know, what's with the delay for all these things? Why are you now factoring in 10 years for this project? And he said, well, one of the issues is that on Bord Pleanála, it doesn't have any compelling timeline to deal with things, that when an issue is referred to them, that it could be possibly held up for years, because there is no obligation on planning authorities to give you a turnaround within 4 months or 6 months. And that even something like that, it might mean having to resource and Bord Pleanála much more than you currently do, but it might get rid of a lot of those bottlenecks.
Well, indeed. And one would wonder, you know, Fianna Fáil were back in power for, what is it, 18 months or so, why this hasn't happened. And Fine Gael have been in power for 10 years. And, you know, they're very sensible people.
Well, Barry did say there was forthcoming planning review legislation coming, yeah, so maybe that's one of the things they're doing.
Fine Gael have been in power for like 10 years. And, you know, and they see the numbers. They know housing is so important, you know, for people. To all those very good pieces, I would add Sarah Carey's piece in yesterday's Irish Independent, again, talking about, you know, the NIMBYism that Grania just alluded to there, you know, and the famous case in Ranelagh of transient, I won't quite call them transient subjects, but basically transient people wandering through as if, you know, some sort of like weird apartheid. I couldn't quite get my head around that business. Okay. But there is an issue, you know, and Pascal Donoghue has often challenged Eoin O'Brien to say that Sinn Féin is in favour of building houses everywhere except in the Dáil when it comes to votes. So it's a complex issue.
I'm not in favour of building houses in the Dáil either. I think the Dáil should be used as a parliamentary
chamber. Indeed, yeah, mea culpa. But I think planning is ultimately, you know, it's not just about data centres and wind farms, it's ultimately about housing. You know, to go back to what we talked at the top of the hour, the rise in Sinn Féin is associated with the fact that they are promising solutions, you know, and planning would clearly be one of them, because if you don't have the planning permission, you can't build the houses.
Again, Jared Howland in the Sunday Times says people who are older, housed and relatively privileged pull up the drawbridge behind them, which is quite, you know, a dramatic way of putting it. Mm. But, supply won't solve every issue with the housing crisis, but it is a huge kind of plank or pillar or skeleton to solving it. And the planning issues, you know, that, you know, the headline of Jared's piece is on board planola issues just keep on building up, which is kind of, I do feel like as a journalist, I am seeing on board planola planning issues again and again in the headlines for the wrong reasons. And it does need to be kind of addressed. And it is boring and it is not a voter issue in a lot of ways, but it's one of those things that the reasons government's there.
But it is a voter issue when you come to think of it about what people are going to vote for, which is housing.
People vote for infrastructure as well, because, like, you know, you might argue that there's this NIMBYism that nobody wants a new housing estate in their back garden, but everyone wants, you know, the new metro line, everyone wants the new Dart line and the new Lewis line to run close to their house. Well, and then they don't want other housing there to be supplied by it.
I've worked in DCU now for nearly a quarter of a century.
You'll get that metro soon.
Long time. But this is I despaired, you know, when I read the headlines about Metro North not coming. I mean, you know, those of us on the north side, you know, we exist as well, and our students exist, and you know, and the bus routes across, the buses are fine and they're regular, but, you know, they take a long time.
Grania, you mentioned the idea of people pulling up the drawbridge behind themselves. Is that what's happened in Glasgow in the last couple of days, where you have Western economies that built their societies on the basis of using fossil fuels, and now in other countries try to replicate them and grow at the same rate? Now the West is saying, can't be doing that, lads.
Well, that is why climate finance is so important, because in a lot of ways, developed countries are profiting off of, being kind of unsustainable, unenvironmental policies that are affecting the climate, that are exacerbating climate or temperatures and dramatic weather events in kind of less developed parts of the world. And now there is a reckoning to that. You know, it's not a good look, but if the more developed countries are funding other countries to have more sustainable, you know, ways of operating, you know, one of the things that it's too early for a lot of developing countries to move to electric, for example, or more renewable energy supplies. So there is going to be an interim kind of fuel for developing countries, probably gas, while they move away from coal. But then you have India, in a country where is it half of the population doesn't have access to electricity, and you're asking them to care about climate change.
Coal scavenging is a huge thing for them. Yeah,
I mean, it was going great COP26 until literally yesterday, when there was a lot of pretty
well. Was it going great?
Because I think
it finished with India deciding that we weren't going to phase out coal, and it started with India saying we'll be net zero by 2070, which is 20 years after everyone else.
I mean, great was probably a bit over the top, but it seemed to be going reasonably well. That's a better phrase. Yeah.
It wasn't going terribly.
I give out to my students for using great in that context. but I thought it was entirely predictable, I think, for the very reasons Grania says, in terms of half the population of India without electricity. You know, the world's most populous democracy. And we all know the issues in China. So you know, the skeptic in me always worries about, you know, the, if you look at Michael Brennan's piece in the Post today about, you know, electric car zones only, I'm not sure how that would be policed. And, you know, we're doing a lot here, but it's minuscule in the grander scheme of things about climate change.
We'll be discussing more that we have to do with John Gibbons a little bit later, but I'm afraid we're completely out of time. Groaning the A, Gary Murphy, thank you both very much for joining us this lunchtime on The Record.
On The Record, on News Talk,
brought to you by PwC, a community of solvers coming together in unexpected ways. It all adds up to the new equation.